Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
East Coast food. I arrived in Boston and went to the grocery store, and it was like the saddest little tomato, and I cried.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today with Marisa Lagos. Well, for decades, Roe v. Wade was the law of the land. Anti-abortion groups used it to raise money, organize opposition, recruit and fund candidates who were anti-abortion, and to pressure Republican presidents to appoint judges likely to overturn Roe. Well, after President Trump named three justices to the Supreme Court, anti-abortion advocates succeeded with the Dobbs decision 2 years ago, striking down Roe and leaving abortion access up to the states. Well, now the tables are turned, and Republicans are on the defensive, even more so after Alabama banned IVF treatments for women trying to get pregnant, and states like Texas and Florida enacted extreme bans on abortion, like the Civil War era law resurrected by Arizona's Supreme Court last week. Our guest today is Heidi Seek, who's made a career out of fighting for abortion rights and access and helping to elevate women into political office across the country. She'll be here to discuss all of that and more. But first, Marisa, let's talk about something happening a little closer to home, which is the apparent recall of Pamela Price. The DA in Alameda County has apparently succeeded. They've turned in enough signatures. About 40% of those signatures were invalidated, but they did just barely, by about 1,600, get more than they needed. And yet, once again, a progressive DA is going to be facing the voters after being elected. And, you know, we've seen this here in San Francisco. We've seen it kind of try
attempted
and fail
in L.A.
Yeah. So and it's coming in a very sort of fraught moment when it comes to public safety.
It is. I mean, there's a lot sort of going on around the criminal justice and criminal justice reform conversation more broadly, but also obviously in politics more broadly, as you just set up in your intro. And so I think that what's going to be fascinating to me is to see how or whether outside groups come in to try to help Price in this. If they see this as a sort of litmus test for progressive DAs, the way I think in some ways the Chesa Boudin one was seen in San Francisco, the successful recall of the DA here, although that was right in the aftermath of COVID and things were a little bit, I think, sort of messy politically in a way that in a different way than they will be in this presidential election year, where you have so much focus on these bigger issues as well.
Totally. And the timing of this is very much up in the air. The Alameda County Board of Supes will take it up in a matter of days. And then they have a period of time. Well, let's not get into the details because
it's
very confusing.
Yeah.
It could be on the November ballot with everything else, or it could be earlier. And it's kind of unclear which is better or worse for the DA there haven't been enough of these to know, like, how does it play out?
Yeah. And I mean, is she going to launch into campaign mode? Right now, she has no money, essentially. She had to fire her campaign manager. I know she's got an attorney who's looking at, obviously, the signature process and the sort of whole recall thing carefully. But I do think, again, I mean, it is not ever easy to run for office when you're already, you know, doing the job that you were elected to. It would be even more difficult, I think, in this circumstance. And I do think, you know, you have to acknowledge that whatever you think of Pamela Price and her policies, Oakland has had a longstanding challenge with public safety. They've been without a police chief until recently for over a year. There's been interim chiefs. And we've seen, regardless of who's in the, you know, mayor's office, whether it be Jerry Brown or Libby Schaff or the new mayor, Sheng Tao, or who's in the DA's office, her predecessor was very conservative. Oakland's often had a higher murder rate than any other city in the, you know, in the state. And so I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how all those issues kind of come into play.
And as you well know, because you've been covering this for years, it isn't so simple as to say, well, the crime rate is up, let's get rid of the DA. I mean, there's a whole lot of pieces moving, the police, whether there's presence in the neighborhoods, and just the way people are feeling, you know, like in San Francisco, you know, we don't have a high violent crime rate, but property crimes were really exploding. That really hurt Chesa Boudin, along with the anti-Asian hate crime. crime. So it's really the climate.
Right. And to your point on that, I mean, if this ballot measure to roll back parts of Prop 47 does qualify, as it is largely expected to, and it stays on the ballot, it doesn't get taken off, that would be a statewide ballot measure. That would not be great for Pamela Price, I think, regardless of whether this was an August or a November election, because it would bring, to your point, that sort of climate to the forefront. You would have a well-funded campaign that would, you know, be funded by places like Target and Walmart and Home Depot that would be kind of calling into questions people's safety. And I think that could all really kind of add to this, you know,
totally
tough climate for her.
And you can see Democrats are not exactly unified on this question about, like, say, reforming Proposition 47. You've got Mayor London Breed and the mayors of San Jose and San Diego kind of supporting this ballot measure, whereas Governor Newsom and Democrats in the legislature want to go in a different direction, kind of go after organized retail theft rings. All of that is like this stew of issues that
Very
are going to play out. And Pamela Price is going to have to deal with that in her recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
and
gonna
we'll find out when the date's going to be. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll be talking about the politics of abortion in this presidential election year with organizer Heidi Seek. She's co-founder of Vote Pro Choice and a veteran political organizer. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And our guest today is Heidi Seek. She's co-founder of Vote Pro Choice, which champions abortion access at the local, state, and national level. She's worked on 8 presidential campaigns over the years, including Kamala Harris's 2020 presidential run. And now she's helping to organize women and raise money in support of San Francisco Mayor London Breed's re-election. Heidi Seek, welcome to Political Breakdown. Good to have you.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Unfortunately, we have to talk about very complicated and difficult issues.
We do. And so give us
the
landscape.
But we'll have fun while we do it.
Yes, we will.
Yeah, we'll
and that's
try.
Essential.
Yeah. So give us the landscape. So much has changed since the Dobbs decision, starting with the Dobbs decision, which came down like a thunderbolt, although there was that leaked opinion that gave people a kind of a sense of what was coming. But as you look out now, what do you see? How have things changed? What is the political environment?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that nothing has happened has surprised me at all. I started my political career when my grandfather was an elected state senator in Nebraska in the 90s, like the early 90s. And so I was working in the unicameral as a young person when the very first pieces of legislation that were being introduced by the ultra-conservative anti-choice machine to try to chip away at Roe. And so I have been watching the systemic chipping away, the attempt to limit our reproductive freedom for the last 30 years. So nothing that has happened in the last few years has surprised me at all. Unfortunately, you know, we've lost Roe v. Wade in what I consider a pro-choice nation. We know across the board, all polling tells us that 80% of our country does not want their elected officials making decisions about their pregnancies, about their reproductive freedom. Men, women, non-binary people, Republicans, independents, not declined to stay, Democrats, across the board, this is true. And so we really are in a complex situation of an unbelievable patchwork of access to reproductive health and freedom. And it's a technical term would be an absolute mess where people are really being harmed.
Do you think then, given that what you laid out in terms of the numbers and the sort of wide demographic support for at least some access, that this is a winning issue for Democrats? Or is it confusing because people don't often vote on only one issue?
Well, that's absolutely true. People don't vote on an issue, but I think we underestimate the foundational nature of reproductive freedom, and we have done so for the last many decades as a Democrat to our peril. So in a lot of ways, you know, I've watched a very organized infrastructure on the anti-choice side, mobilize a particular faction, a demographic that is extremely anti-choice, but they knew that they had to in order to win elections.
And they worked over decades to do
decades,
that.
Decades, right? Decades. And I was watching that infrastructure happen in the states. You know, meanwhile, as an active member of the Democratic Party, as you said, I've worked on countless elections, state and local, across the country. And what I have seen is that we, I'll just be honest, like, Democrats don't really understand their electorate. Mm. And one of the reasons why is because it's an interesting thing. Like, our strategy is often a policy-oriented strategy. It's, let's just get elected and then we'll legislate good policy. And so therefore, over the course of the last decades, we've been investing in a minimal amount of voter conversation. Like, we want to win by 50 plus one. That's it. Yeah. Which means that over the last 30 years, where we've been watching the chipping away of our reproductive freedom, mostly at the state legislative level, we have failed to have conversations with people and meet them where they are on the issue of reproductive freedom.
Well, and you said in, I think, 2019, the Democrats play it too safe on the issue of abortion. What did you mean by that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, I think that the idea of abortion access has been very constrained to a certain group of people, women, let's say, and really given the responsibility of mobilizing or discussing that to a particular faction of organizations like Planned Parenthood and NARAL and the feminist majority and those kinds of conversations. Those organizations are amazing and they've done amazing work, particularly the health access of Planned Parenthood. But for the most part, I have noticed or observed over the decades that these organizations are really mobilizing what they consider their base. Women, people that vote on abortion as a single issue. And therefore, there's this huge amount of voters that were not being spoken to where they are. You know, people that might have complex feelings about access to abortion or, you know, just may not really want to talk about it. And frankly, the Democratic Party hasn't been great about embracing reproductive freedom and abortion access until Roe v. Wade was overturned. And that's a shame.
Well, now you have it on the ballot in swing states like Arizona, mm-hmm. in purple states like Florida. Is that a potential path to victory for the Biden-Harris ticket?
Oh, I think so, for sure. I mean, it's a I wish we weren't here, but even just the Kansas ballot initiative, the Montana ballot initiative, the Kentucky ballot initiative, all winning, it never surprised me because we were hearing this from all of the voters that we had mobilized at Vote Pro Choice. I mean, we have been speaking to and mobilizing over 95 million voters over the last 8 years, and we're talking about down ballot races, folks that are low propensity voters, independents. These folks are incensed by the failure to have access to abortion. And that is something that can be mobilized now.
Well, I want to pivot to another down ballot race, the race for mayor here in San Francisco. You're working with Mayor London Breed, mm-hmm. Helping her raise money, helping organize women on her behalf. What's the message? What's the pitch?
Well, you know, Mayor London Breed has had quite a time as in serving her position. I mean, you think about from a human perspective, she became mayor overnight because of the death of Mayor Lee. Then there was a leadership coup where she wasn't mayor suddenly, and then she had to run for mayor when she didn't plan on it. She became mayor, and then what was she faced with is crisis after crisis after crisis. You have a global pandemic where she was an incredibly effective leader in a disaster situation and the fentanyl crisis and everything that's happened over the course of the last 6 years.
But when you look at the polls, voters are very unhappy with the direction of the city, mm-hmm. and with her leadership. So how do you turn that around on her behalf?
Rightfully so. And so now what's interesting about the next phase is there is no one in this city, as a person who has known London Breed for over 20 years, who understands the communities and loves San Francisco more than Mayor London Breed. I mean, I have known her and worked with her and been an organizer with her for decades. And so I really do believe that that her understanding of the community and her vision for the city will manifest itself so powerfully in the next term that I really personally believe that she should have a chance to show us that vision. And it's really inspiring to me.
Yeah, and clearly her political weakness has invited a lot of strong challengers into the race who are, you know, all men, actually. Mm-hmm. So clearly that'll be one of her talking points. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. We're talking with Heidi Seek, co-founder of Vote Pro Choice.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about how you got to this chair you're sitting in right now talking to us. So you mentioned Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more. You were born in D.C., though?
No, I was born in San Francisco.
In San Francisco. Yes, tell us a little bit about your
UCSF.
Family.
UCSF. Okay. My dad was a gay HIV-positive activist artist who marched with Harvey Milk, and he was very much part of the transformation of San Francisco during the AIDS epidemic. He helped mobilize for the creation of the Haight Street Free Clinic and the first medical marijuana co-ops for AIDS patients. And his ashes are resting on Angel Island with a lot of his partners and lovers and friends who we lost in the AIDS epidemic. So San Francisco and the Renaissance of San Francisco is in my DNA.
But Nebraska.
Yes. Well, you know, my parents split up when I was little. As you can imagine, that was a very complex relationship in the 1970s. So I grew up in Nebraska. My dad was always here all of my life.
And would you come back and see him?
Very rarely. Yeah, very rarely. But certainly I was like connected to the history of San Francisco. Yeah. And I moved back here in 1994 and started working in City Hall, actually. I worked for Mayor Brown, Mayor Newsom, Mayor Lee, working on innovative projects. But then on the side, as a volunteer, I was president of the San Francisco Women's Political Committee, and I worked with a lot of women, organizing women for elected office here. And that's where I met London Breed and Kamala Harris, and was an early endorser of Kamala when she was running for district attorney. So San Francisco and the equity-based leadership of this city is so important to me, and it's in my bones.
One of the things you worked on was the creation of the 311 system.
Which I use all the time.
Yes.
Complaining
yes.
about this or that.
Yes,
and
that's right.
And actually, the city responds, so it's
they
working.
Do. Yes.
It's working. How did you get involved in that, and do you see any connection to that kind of work with the work you're doing now around women's rights and access to abortion, or is that sort of a one-off?
Actually, it's a really interesting question because no one has really made that connection with me before, but it is totally 100% connected. I was working for Mayor Brown, and then when Mayor Newsom was running for mayor and became mayor, he was really interested in government innovation. So we were working on tech and open data and more accountability and metrics-based programs. And I happened to have some private sector experience. So I was slated to run that project because I had the experience of doing it. And I was really proud of building it. But what I also realized that is a project that's based on service to the folks in San Francisco, the voters, the businesses, the undocumented residents. Like, it's you pay your taxes in order to have service from your city, and so therefore your city should serve you back. But technology is very powerful in helping with that. And so, you know, fast forward to I find myself on the East Coast, I find with Donald Trump is running for president, I'm like, what am I going to do? And actually, interestingly, a friend of mine who worked with me in City Hall in San Francisco texted me and said,
name's Heidi. Who was it?
It was actually Mike Farah.
Okay.
Do you remember Mike Farah?
He's back.
He was a senior advisor to Mayor Newsom, and he texted me and he said, everything that you have done in your career has prepared you for this moment. And so bringing together some disaster response experience I had in the city, technology foundation, mobilizing people, providing information for voters, it really is the foundation of Vote Pro Choice. I mean, we are in a disaster. The Trump election was a disaster. Our post-Roe world is a disaster. And so we must treat it as such and mobilize people and use the tools at our fingertips in order to do that. And that's really what I've been doing for the last 15 years.
So you co-found Vote Pro Choice, which essentially in 2015, really before, I guess, Trump was running, but we didn't, you know yet. And I wonder, like, why you saw this as something that needed to be tackled on the state and local level. I think so much attention had been paid to the Supreme Court, to the national, you know, to Congress. And it really, it seems like set you guys ahead of the curve when Dobbs did get overturned. So like, or when Dobbs was issued. So how, why did you see that as the path for reproductive rights, that it needed to be local and state elections?
I'm so glad you asked that because it was the lack of investment in the state legislatures that I was seeing over the course of decades. And I hope you've had discussions about this in your previous podcast episodes or your conversations here. It really is. We really saw it in 2010 when Barack Obama as president lost all the state legislatures. And that was a red flag for our failure to invest in those down ballot local races. And I was there. You know, I was working in Ohio. I saw what was going on in the state legislatures there at the time.
When you said your grandfather was a state legislator?
He was a state senator in Nebraska. So
was
that
he a
was happening. He was a Democrat.
Okay.
They
Isn't
had
that
Democrats
amazing?
Back then. No, yeah, I know. Bob
it
Kerry
was like
was
all five. Yes, yes, that's right. And he was the governor at the time. So a very, very, and again, that again proves like sort of the libertarian perspective of a lot of the Midwest. 80% of the country does not want their elected officials making these decisions for them. And the failure to invest in addressing the fact that the GOP and the conservative anti-choice infrastructure was focusing on state legislatures, and we did not meet that moment at scale. That is what Vote Pro-Choice was all about, is trying to get some resources to those state and local offices.
It seems like younger voters in particular are very unhappy with the Democratic Party. A lot of that is over Gaza and Israel. Mm-hmm. But also young women have a lot at stake in terms of abortion access, reproductive rights, and so on. How do you think about talking to those voters who are thinking of sitting it out or voting for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. or, you know, maybe voting for Donald Trump?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to be such a complex puzzle that we are facing this year. I'm Jewish. You know, this is a complex, difficult time in our country that all these issues are coming to fore. And we weren't really going to know because we have so many young people who have not been part of the voting majority in this country. Again, like I said, we don't really know our voters that well. There are complex issues like international issues now, like reproductive freedom, like, you know, economic accessibility that are going to be at play. Climate change. Oh, yes. That we don't know. I know that that the country is on the side of reproductive freedom. The country is on the side of common sense gun reform, on climate change. They want a better, more equitable world. And is that going to play out in the unbelievable puzzle of access to voting, how they're feeling about their elected officials? I will say that these ballot initiatives and local offices are very inspirational to people. Young people particularly want authenticity, and they want direct access to their leaders. And at the state and local level, we really do have a shot of mobilizing young people to be participating in civic life in a way that the presidential may not inspire them. Mm-hmm. So I am excited. I am actually very curious to see what happens in Arizona or Florida, where there is a universe. So there's a ballot initiative in Florida where you're going to have more people voting for that ballot initiative than will vote for Biden or Trump. It's likely. And I'm very curious to see that.
Not to mention weed, also on the ballot in Florida. Speaking of young people, I do want to ask you about the second half of the ticket, Kamala Harris. You worked with her in her campaign for DA. You led her fundraising efforts in her short but significant presidential campaign in 2020. And, you know, she is out there a lot talking about abortion rights and other issues that I think do play to her strengths. But, you know, she, like Biden, is underwater, especially she's very popular among Democrats. They actually both are. Mm-hmm. But if you look at polling averages, you know, she has strength with Black voters, with Latino voters, but not with swing voters in general. I just wonder, like, How do you think, knowing Kamala Harris, the Biden campaign should be using her, and what should she be out there talking about?
I personally think that she is doing an incredible job on so many issues. I am focused on reproductive freedom, and there's nobody better. And I will admit that a lot of the work that I do, Vote Pro Choice, is really a manifestation of what I learned from her when she was district attorney, where she realized that a lot of the protection of reproductive freedom must happen at the state and local level, and she did it. And she would talk about, she would often say, oh, you want to talk about women's issues? Let's talk about the economy. Let's talk about public safety. Let's talk about the environment. I mean, isolating women's issues to just a certain number, like abortion or birth control or even childcare for that matter, that's not a woman's issue. It's an everyone issue. And so I really appreciate that she's out there talking about this and leading on this. And I just want more coverage of all that she's doing and saying.
Before we let you go, I do want to ask about something we have talked about a lot on the show, which is the loss of women leaders in California. We went from having two women U.S. senators to having, after November, none. We've seen Barbara Lee retiring, not at her choice, but going, you know, not winning the top two in the Senate. Katie Porter will no longer be in the House. Anna Eshoo. You know, what are your thoughts about that? And the fact that in some cases, women like Nancy Pelosi helped elevate Adam Schiff.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I do what I do, because, you know, the national election is going to be what it is. But at the end of the day, Joe Biden started as an elected public defender. Kamala Harris started an elected district attorney. It's invest in the local offices. It's why I came back. I came home to help Mayor Breed. It's where our future leaders will reside. And again, over time, over the last many decades, we have failed to invest in these local offices for too long at our peril, and therefore manifesting in the loss of women leaders at the highest level. And so therefore, by investing in the local, we can change that trajectory.
All about the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Heidi Sieg, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us. A really interesting conversation.
Thank you very much.
And that is a wrap for Tuesday, April 16th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineer is Seal Muller. Our producer is Dana Cronin. I'm Scott Schaefer, along with Marisa Lagos. Thanks so much for listening.